Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Roll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Special Wednesday edition. I've got Jared Jared Dubin from Hardwood Paroxysm. Jason Concepcion. Did I say that right? I probably butchered that as well. Otherwise known as Network. You guys have been a part of a Linsanity book that is literally out today as people are listening to this.
That is accurate.
True statement.
Jared, how did this come about? What gave you guys the idea?
At least for me, I had been considering doing something like this throughout last season, but didn't take the initiative in terms of starting it. And it turned out that at the same time that I was considering it, Seth Rosenthal from Posting and Toasting was considering it, and Mike Carrillo, Bob Silverman, and Jim Cavan from Knickerblogger were all considering it as well. And they kind of went around and got together pretty much the exact group of people that I would have asked to do the same project. And they actually did it because they're not lazy and I am.
That's always a good start. That's been the problem with the majority of my projects is that I just never think to finish them. Jason, what got you involved with this? What made you want to join in on the Linsanity book?
They asked me. It's like the Seven Samurai, but of sadness.
Sure.
And basically, most of my contribution was just tweets, so it's literally the easiest. I did the easiest possible thing.
Right.
And I get to be part of a book.
Did you have to go back and find your own tweets, or did they have some of them already?
I went through and just kind of compiled a list according to topic, you know, like Tony Douglas, Tyson Chandler, Mike Bibby, and then just
some of the Tony Douglas ones were really vile, disgusting things.
That's expected.
Yeah, it is.
The books will always have Linsanity, and I don't want to speak for Knicks fans here. Jason, maybe you can answer this first. It seems like the happiest time for a Knicks fan was the Linsanity era since, I don't know when, maybe like Chris Childs punching Kobe.
Completely. It's a lot like 99 because it was just completely unexpected.
Yeah.
You know, it was like found money, you know, there was no way to foresee what happened. And even as it was happening, you knew that this will never happen again. So it was great. It was really fun.
That was one of my favorite parts of I'm 22 pages into the book right now, and going through and seeing the writing coupled with Jason's tweets, it reminds me because that was really when I made sure like I saw a tweet from Network throughout every Knicks game. Like there was a point where I was like, all right, he is like appointment viewing for tweeting. And Jared, I talked to you in the Daily Dime live chat almost nightly while it was going on, it seemed like. And your reactions to it seemed to be, you weren't trying to get too high on it, but you were making sure like you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd say that's definitely accurate. And that's actually one of the chapters in the book is a roundtable that Jason, me, and Seth Rosenthal did where it was basically describing that kind of reaction and conversation that you're talking about where we were obviously very excited, and it was the most fun we've had as Knicks fans in a long time. But a lot of it was, okay, we can't say anything too big because we don't want to jinx it. And if we say anything, it'll all come crashing down. And obviously, that kind of happened when he got hurt.
Right.
But that was a very big part of the experience for me, and I think for Jason as well, where it was trying to find a balance between how excited we were and how much we really just we're praying that it didn't end.
I think the thing that I've liked about reading this so far is that I just forgot about the mood of the team as it was being constructed. And there's a part where it's like, oh, Baron Davis is here. That's cool. Like there was just this weird. There was a level of excitement because Melo was in town now, right?
Definitely.
Yes.
And yet. I mean, you guys aren't the type of fans to, or at least from my interaction with you, you're not the type of fans to really overreact to an acquisition or anything, but you had to have felt like Jason, you had to have felt like the Knicks were headed in the right direction, but it took a completely different turn, like, in January.
Oh, yeah. It was funereal. I mean, if we're talking about the time just as Lynn made his way into the lineup, I mean, it was dire. You know, there are certain assumptions made about the team, especially at the point guard position, that just didn't pan out. And it really just hampered the Knicks for the early part of the season until Lynn came in. They were a good defensive team. They just couldn't score. You know, Tony Douglas wasn't a point guard. Baron Davis, you know, wasn't healthy. Mike Bibby was, you know, 5,000 years old. and you know, it was really a depressing time until Lynn came in, and then it was just like 180.
Jared, at what point did you think, like, holy crap, this is a thing?
I guess it was maybe, like, I don't remember how many games into the streak of whatever he was doing it was, but I think it was the Raptor game where he just went crazy, and then he calmly walked up the court with like 5 or 6 seconds left and just drilled a three right from the top of the key. And I was like, what is going on right now? Like, I couldn't even form full sentences. Every sentence was one word.
Right. I don't want to discount what Lynn did, but it does help having Jose Calderon play defense on you at the end of a game.
Yes. For me,
it was impressive.
Yeah.
For me, it was spin move at the end of the Laker game where he scored 38 at the Garden. That was where I was like, no, what is this?
And so, I think the thing about the whole insanity thing is that it became such a big thing so fast that it, I mean, just with the day and age that we're in, it immediately has to have a backlash.
Right.
And it almost seemed to get, I mean, not that it wasn't blown out of proportion by the media and everything, but it almost seemed to get more blown out of proportion by opposing fans, right?
Yeah. I think it was there was a kind of consciousness that it was being blown out of proportion, and how much it was being blown out of proportion was almost blown out of proportion itself. It was very meta.
It's like a lot of exponents going on here.
Yeah.
I think especially after that Heat game, which was on national TV right before the All-Star break, and he just kind of got completely shut down, that's when a big conversation picked up, like, all right, none of this is real. The Heat just showed exactly how to stop him. And a lot of that was also because that's the Heat. They're really good.
Right.
And what they do is shut down the specific things that Lynn is good at, like coming directly off a screen and coming into the lane. They don't let you do that. So it was kind of the worst possible scenario for him in that given game.
Well, I think something like a correlation for me, this is going to shock people that have ever, you know, seen me tweet or talk on the podcast, but I kind of draw the comparison to Rubio in the sense that Rubio is not perfect by any means, but he's a lot of fun, and so you kind of just get caught up in the moment, and you just enjoy watching him play. And I felt like Lynn was a similar thing for Knicks fans. Is that kind of, I mean, cause especially like things have been such crap for a decade.
Oh, without a doubt. I think part of it was that even when the Knicks are terrible, there's expectations of something.
Why is that?
Like,
is it just because it's New York?
I've been thinking about this for a long time. It's just ridiculous. I don't really know, but I have some ideas, and that's like a whole nother podcast. But he came in, and there was like literally no expectations. You just had no idea. You're like, okay, well, we'll just throw this kid in there because he's a body, and we need bodies. And that's part of what made it so great. There were zero expectations. It was the first time in a long time where you just were like, okay, let's just see what happens. Let's throw this out there and see what happens. There wasn't like, this is the piece or this is the guy that's going to get them to this level. It was just like, let's just survive this stretch.
And wasn't there something like he was about to get cut near right before the season, and then Baron Davis had a setback, and that's how he wound up staying on the team? And then later on, he was about to get sent down, and Baron Davis had another setback, so he stayed on the team again. And then all of a sudden, he played like 6 minutes in garbage time against Houston, and was like, okay, he made like 2 shots or something.
People were like, hey, this guy
might not be terrible.
I don't want to fact check you here, but I don't foresee any situation in which Baron Davis had a setback.
You're telling me that old guys get hurt?
That doesn't sound right.
No, that's not right.
Wait, is there a bigger discrepancy between the Isaiah Thomas era and then just 3 months of Jeremy Lin being a lot of fun, or 2 months, whatever it was?
In terms of the gap, are you talking about like the cavernous Grand Canyon-ish gap between those two things?
Sure. Maybe a Grand Canyon's a good measuring unit there. It just seems like, because there was, I mean, Jason, there was nothing fun about the Isaiah Thomas era other than making jokes about yourself, right?
Let me try to think. No, there was really nothing. It was just like a constant barrage of bad news and tons of money and bad basketball and just terribleness and bad things happening off the court. It was bad. If you couldn't, at that time, you couldn't imagine anything good ever happening to the Knicks. So it was night and day for sure.
Jared, did it get to a point, at least with like the Isaiah Thomas era, was there ever a point where a story came up or a signing happened and you didn't just think, oh, of course?
I think I still feel that way now.
Really?
I mean, not necessarily. We've obviously made much better moves. And yes, I'm going to use the we here. But we've obviously made much better moves since the Isaiah era ended. But there's still really nothing that surprises me. As like you see the stories these days about the way that the injuries are handled, and it's just like, well, that's the Knicks. That's just how things go. But in terms of the difference in funness, I think Jason's definitely right, where just the cavernous difference between those Isaiah years, which was like, is there something deeper than depression? Like, is there a level past that?
I think it's called Cleveland.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, when the only thing that you can hope for is that people get fired, like that's your hope, that people lose their job, that's not a good place to be.
Isn't that a weird part of sports where you actually hope people, their lives, I mean, that's a big thing to get fired, even if you're making a lot of money in severance. Like, that's a weird thing to root for.
And that's all we had, is just like, please let this guy get fired. It's terrible.
And for
terrible.
Like years upon years too. It's not just like a 2 or 3 month period like it was for, say, Laker fans and Mike Brown. This was going on for like 3 or 4 years. There were pickets outside Madison Square Garden.
That was crazy. And just how embarrassing it was, you know, with the lawsuit and the whole like, do you want to get in the truck and the sexual harassment. It was bad. Oh, my God, it was bad.
I had forgotten about the sex truck incident. I remembered the sexual harassment, but I completely blocked out the whole Marbury thing.
Oh, God.
That was really weird.
That wasn't even the end of it with Marbury. He had the whole thing with D'Antoni.
It's never the end.
And then he started, and that was before he started eating Vaseline on live TV.
Right.
Oh, man. I've tweeted this before, but really the high point of Isaiah's tenure in terms of fun for Knicks fans was when he traded Keith Van Horn, and then the Garden chanted Keith Van Horn, Keith Van Horn the very next game. That was like as fun as it got while the Knicks were getting blown out.
Or I think that there was, I don't remember what year it was. I'm pretty sure I was a sophomore in college when he was already coaching the team at this point, and he got them into eighth place for one day. And Dolan gave him a contract extension on the spot.
I mean, that's a bold move.
He's a trusting guy.
How do you deal with James Dolan, with JD in the straight shot as a fan? I mean, I know.
Yeah. Have you ever been to a show?
No. That was. I had Dan Devine on the podcast maybe 2 weeks ago. Week or two ago, and I had asked him about like what his favorite album was of JD and the Straight Shot, and he said like that was the one thing he couldn't support in any way, like not even listen to a song because of his like hatred of what James Dolan has done to the Knicks. But I feel like that's the one thing I would be able to like revel in.
I think the only song I've ever heard is "Fix the Knicks."
I've heard another one, and there's. He's got this, like, there's, like, a musical snippet that's in or what is that, that AMC ripoff of that AMC like Western show? Their song,
yeah,
Hell on Wheels.
Their song, Hell on Wheels. Their song is like the theme of that.
Of course it is.
Yeah, I'm trying to pitch to somebody like me doing an interview with James Dolan, but we just jam. We just like two guitars. Let's just 45 minutes. Let's just play the blues, James. Forget this Nick stuff. Let's just jam and talk about the blues.
Do you play?
Yeah.
Have you ever gone to an audition? I'm sure he's got to like need like just backup guitarists here and there.
You know what? His this is like his band is very good. I mean, he has the money to hire really good guys to play with him. That's another thing. Imagine being so rich that you're like, you know what I like? I like playing music. I'm just going to hire guys, the best guys. And then I'm just going to do that.
I can relate because I found $8 in my pocket the other day and
there you go.
Felt like I was the king of the world. I imagine it's a lot like that.
It's got to be.
In the book, what I do like is that you guys are saying, like, don't forget about Bill Walker. Don't forget about Steve Novak. And I think part of the thing was that, you know, Jeremy Lin was a role player. Well, he was an afterthought who became a role player, who became like a star, who became like a role player again. But the role players they had on that team and still have on that team are extremely quirky, but it works in a way that, you know, a lot of fans like to say, oh, we have the bench mob and our bench is so wild and weird. But with the Knicks, like it was kind of an embodiment of what people think about New York City. There was just something of everything. And for some reason, like, Jared, that seems to make it even more of a Knicks-y situation.
Think about the crew of characters. Like, not just, you know, people, like, characters that were on that bench. Like, Novak with his discount double check. Bill Walker with the single worst hair in the league. and his headband. J.R. Smith came back from China in the middle of the season. Then you had Baron Davis, who weighed, like, approximately 400 pounds. Mike Bibby, who was approximately 400 years old. Like, it was just the weirdest group of people that could possibly be on the bench of an NBA team. And I think, those are Seth's chapters where he's the one that did
right. All
the don't that forget is, about.
Yeah.
And I think that he was kind of the perfect person to capture that because he loves those supporting guys. Like, he's adopted Ronaldo Bachman as his son.
My favorite was him writing about Josh Harrelson, a.k.a. Jorts.
Oh, that was great.
That was my favorite one. So what went wrong in terms of basketball? Like, obviously the Lin injury hurt, but why didn't he and Mel, like, why couldn't he and Melo coexist? Because Melo's played with Andre Miller in it, and it worked. And Andre Miller dominates the ball as much as any, like, average point guard, right?
Yeah, he's played with, I mean, you look at Felton, he's dominated the ball as much this year as Lin did last year, but I think the difference kind of was where I think Melo just trusted Felton more because he's been in the league more, and you've heard guys say this a lot, the guys on the team talk about how much more they trust in experienced guys, and obviously I wasn't the biggest fan of that strategy in the offseason, but if the players trust more, then that's, if you're building a team around a certain guy, which the Knicks are built around Melo, then that's how you build the team, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, it's not like Melo hasn't played with good or ball-dominant point guards before. Like you said, he played with Andre Miller, with Felton now. He played with Chauncey Billups. He played with Allen Iverson. Those are all guys who had the ball a lot. It's not like he couldn't play with a guy who had the ball. He just trusted more in a guy who had more experience. And that was why, I guess, why they had to move on, even though you could have had both of those players on the same team, and all it would cost was money.
Is that the most frustrating you can remember as like a Knicks fan, Jason? Just because everyone thought he was going to resign, and you clearly were drawn. I mean, not the most frustrating you think you've ever gone through with the Knicks, because
in terms of a move,
yeah,
yes. In terms of a move, yes. That was absolutely the bottom. I've been more depressed at stuff that has happened on the court. But in terms of a move, that was definitely like that, because you became like, you know, I'm pretty cynical, but I had, you know, a lot of people who are pretty cynical Knicks fans had become really invested at that point.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was brutal. Brutal.
I've definitely had more frustrating moments as a Knicks fan in terms of just pure moments. Like, you think about the Ewing finger roll or like the entire John Starks game. But in terms of an off-season move, I think that was definitely, if it's not the most frustrated I've been, it's in the top three, and only because I want to leave some room for improvement.
Did you feel like they were just like, it was just the Onion breaking news when it happened?
You know, I knew that. I kind of actually, because everyone was saying, oh yeah, they re-sign him. Come on. No way. I was actually like, wait, this doesn't feel right. You know, kind of like when you sleep through your alarm and you feel like really rested and you're like, why am I so rested? Why? That's what I felt like. I kind of felt like, oh, this is too, everybody's saying that they're going to sign him. It's too positive.
I was, it was 3 weeks before I was taking the bar exam.
Oh, that's right.
And I was in the middle of a self-imposed Twitter hiatus. And Matt Moore texted me, and he's like, you need to check Twitter right now. Re-Lin. And I was like, I didn't even know what to think. And then I saw, you know, Seth freaking out, Jason freaking out, Jim and Mike and everybody else freaking out. Like, oh, the Knicks might not re-sign Lin. They might be moving for Raymond Felton. And I was like, all right, I'm getting back off Twitter because I can't do this. And then Matt texted me the next day, and he's like, you need to freak out right now. What is wrong with you? So, yeah, it was interesting.
Really, the most fascinating thing to me about the whole situation was how much race played into it on both sides, because you have, like, I wrote about this, I don't know where I wrote about this, but at some point I wrote about this where it was like, Jeremy Lin is like the most normal looking Asian basketball player you've ever seen, because
right.
Yao Ming was 7'5", Wang Zhuzhu was 7'1" or whatever, like Yijian Lin was 6'11". Like, Jeremy Lin is someone you would walk down the street and not notice because he looks so normal, and that's why it seemed such like a fairy tale, at least like from my perspective looking in, because this was just a guy off. I mean, it wasn't just a guy off the street. Like, this guy had a scholarship to Harvard and had gone to the NCAA tournament. Like, he was clearly a basketball player, and he had been, you know, had a couple of short stints around the league, but he essentially was just a guy off the street. And because of his culture, how that's not really that widely represented in pro sports, like it just seemed so different. And people seemed to like kind of resent that. Like, oh, if he wasn't Asian, this wouldn't be if he wasn't Asian American, this wouldn't be a story. And it's like, well, right, it's okay that it is a story because of that and the team he plays for and the way things are unfolding. Jason, did that bother you at all? Did you get that sense?
I still get that sense. It was really two-sided, because it was, I think it's true that if he wasn't Asian American, his draft stock would have been higher.
Right.
And then I do think that it's true that if he wasn't Asian American, it wouldn't have been quite as big a story. But I think novelty in terms of his race in the environment of basketball plays into it. I don't understand why people then try to discount the things he did. The numbers and his player are what they are. I mean, you look at how he's played over the last 2 months of the season without really any fanfare. And he's an NBA player, you know? He can play in the NBA. Whereas some people would take it's because he's Asian. They take that and they take it to the extreme where, oh, he shouldn't even be in the NBA. People are only freaking out because he's Asian.
And it seems like there's a point where maybe his appearance at first like kind of let down the guard of defenders, but 3-4 games in, nobody wanted to be taken by this guy, right? Like, no one wanted him to drop 25 or 30 points on them. So at that point, race is out of the window, and guys are just guarding him because he's good now.
Well, I think that you're in Deron Williams took it really personally because the first game of the quote Linsanity stretch came against the Nets when he had like 25 points and 7 or 8 assists or whatever it was. And then Deron Williams kept on hearing about it, kept on hearing about it, kept on hearing about it. And he took it extremely personally the next time they played. I think I'm pretty sure he played really well the next time they played.
Yeah.
But it was like a big thing for him. Like, I have to take down Jeremy Lin, and I have to be the one to do it. But I think you're definitely right in terms of, you know, he's a very, not necessarily slight, but he's smaller than other Asian players that have been in the league. And even though he's strong, he's kind of a very unassuming stature on the court when he just walks out there. You know, he's 6'3", like 180 something pounds.
He's a good sized guy. Like, it's not like
right.
Earl Boykins is out there.
That's you know, a good size. It's bigger than me.
Right.
But you see a person like that on the street, like you said, it's, you know, it's just okay. That's a slightly tall Asian guy. You don't necessarily think it's an NBA player. And then he gets on the court. He's got this quickness. He's got all these angles that he uses. And I think very quickly it became a thing where not necessarily they wanted to stop him because he was a novelty act, but because he was doing all these things to all these different guys. You know, one day it was the Lakers. One day it was the Mavericks, the NBA champion, hitting threes over Dirk and Marion. And it was the Nets. And it was, you know, everybody else. And guys just wanted to be the one to stop the streak, I guess. I think it was the Hornets that stopped it, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
I did walk by Tony Douglas last time I was in New York. I walked by him on the street, and I didn't feel like he was an NBA player.
I'm not sure he is an NBA player, even accounting for his size.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I'm the right one to broach the Tony Douglas conversation with.
So what do you guys, aside from making millions of dollars, what do you guys hope that comes out of the book? Like, is it like a clarification of what Linsanity meant to Knicks fans, or why the book and now, I guess?
It's just it was really one of the most remarkable stretches for the Knicks, you know, as a team ever in their history, maybe even for many teams. And so we just kind of wanted to chronicle how crazy it was, just in terms of the roller coaster ride, going from being like, well, we're not going to make the playoffs, to this unheralded Asian guard from Harvard basically saving the season.
I'd say it's more so people can get an idea of the experience of what it was like for us and for people, you know, not necessarily just in New York, but, you know, Knicks fans, especially the ones on the internet and in the NBA blogosphere on Twitter, in terms of what it was like for us to experience that rather than to clarify exactly what happened. Like, that's why we've taken, you know, some things that we wrote during last season and, you know, kind of tweaked them a little bit, repurposed them for the book, and then also wrote retrospective things about last season. And that's also, I think, a big part of why we used a lot of Jason's tweets from last season, so it would feel lived in.
Yeah.
And, you know, we took tweets from certain time periods and put them with the corresponding chapters so you could get an idea of what he was feeling and we were feeling at the time.
Do you guys, Jason, I'll start with you. Do you guys still follow him as, I mean, not as closely as if he was on the Knicks, but do you still check out everything he's doing? Like, you guys are very active basketball watchers and tweeters. Do you still feel like, not that you're a fan of his, because I know you are, but do you still feel invested in him?
You know, it's funny. The first thing I tweeted when the Knicks signed him was, because I'm Asian, it was, I am now something like genetically required to follow Jeremy Lin's DNPs.
Yes.
I didn't expect much, but I mean, it's more like I follow the Rockets, actually. They're just, I think, win or lose, whether they win or lose, they're one of the most fun teams to watch in the league, just the way they play.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think if he had wound up on a team that wasn't as fun as the Rockets, I'm not sure if it would be the same way. But they're just so much fun to watch, so much fun to follow, that I wind up paying very close attention to them, especially because you know, him and Harden, and just the way they play with the spread pick and roll, always attacking the lane. It's just extremely fun to watch. So I've wound up watching that team a lot. And I might have, even if he wasn't involved, but I might not have followed it as closely if he had gone to, like, I don't know, Toronto.
Right. Jared, do you think you'll ever stop getting comparisons between what Felton is doing and what Lennon's doing? How long until that subsides?
Well, I think I'll probably get them for the rest of my life. and maybe even beyond that. I imagine that when I get into, you know, wherever I'm going after this, there will be portions of Knicks Twitter waiting there for me with printed out comparisons of Jeremy Lin's career stats and Raymond Felton's career stats and Jason Kidd's career stats and then their narratives from their career as
sure.
well. You can't just use those boring stats, you nerd.
Right. Jason, do you get caught up in the Felton Lin rivalry?
I don't know
if that's the word.
You know, honestly, in the two games that the Knicks have played against the Rockets, I think Felton actually gets way too caught up in it himself. Just, he's really forced stuff. But I try to ignore it now, actually, especially with the Knicks kind of struggling and Lin's PER now above Felton. This is the last time I checked anyway. And the Rockets really playing well. I just try to ignore it. And especially when the Knicks are looking at Delonte West. It's like, we're looking for point guard depth right now. And,
right. Brutal.
Yeah, I try to, I've made it a point this season because I talked about it a lot in the offseason, the comparison between the two of them. I haven't mentioned Lin in connection with the Knicks since the season started, other than the two games that they played against the Rockets.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have that conversation anymore, especially
right.
since we could have had both of them, and that was really the main point, I think.
You're done lighting your mentions on fire?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were a few days where it was like I had to just close the tweet deck because you couldn't even see anything because it just kept coming and coming and coming.
I can only assume that Jeremy Lin is an avid listener of the podcast, because why not?
Of course.
Jared, I'll start with you. If you had one final thing to say to Jeremy Lin, what would it be?
You were a lot of fun when you were in New York, and good luck, I guess. You know, there's not really much else. And good luck on your max contract with the Knicks when you're 38.
Yeah.
Jason, what are your parting words for Lin?
That's exactly what I was going to say. I can't wait to sign you when you're 38, 39. Three-year contract, $25 million.
And we can only hope that Rasheed Wallace will still be around, right?
I think he'll still be making mixtapes with Shump at that time.
Wait, before I was about to end this, but what is it like having Rasheed Wallace on your team? Because Jamal Crawford has always been a favorite of mine, but I've always thought like I would never want him on the Timberwolves because
Jamal Crawford too.
Well, yeah, no, I know that, but I don't know if I can handle that. But Rasheed Wallace, like. I absolutely want him on I want every fan base to experience him.
In all seriousness, Sheed was an absolute highlight of this season so far.
Oh yeah, 100%. I think he might be my favorite player on the team, even though he doesn't do anything. He just kind of sits there. But just in terms of your idea about having every team experience Rasheed Wallace, it gives me an idea because I've been advocating to clone players so we could put them all on every team.
I'm all for this.
I want to put J.J. Redick on every team. I want to put Corey Brewer on every team. And now I want to put Rasheed Wallace on every team.
It makes a lot of sense. We can get the book. We'll always have Linsanity, Strange Takes on the Strangest Season in Knicks History on Amazon.com. Just a cavalcade of Knicks writers, tweeters. You have an introduction by Will Leach, Jason Concepcion, Jared Dubin, Dubin. I call you Dubin because I always called you Jared Dubstep because that's how white I am.
I get things a lot worse than Dubin. At least it's the right letters. Sometimes people will add letters in there. Dublin, Durbin. Like, at least you've got the right letters.
Yeah, just gotta mix up the emphasis a little bit. Thank you guys so much for coming on, and I hope the book sells a million copies.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks a lot, man.